I'm Nell Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm sitting in a field surrounded by willow trees and mud. My son told me that I look like a naked mole rat this morning, so I'm feeling pretty on top of the world. It's always good to have someone on hand to keep your ego in check. My guest this week is the author, editor and broadcaster Nikesh Shukla. Nikesh edited the best-selling essay collection The Good Immigrant, is the co-founder of The Good Literary Agency and is host of the Brown Baby podcast. I once visited Nikesh in Bristol a few years ago, where I'd been sent by The Guardian to learn gymnastics with a bunch of extremely lithe eight-year-olds. I was appalling at it, as you can probably imagine. I knew I wanted to interview Nikesh for this podcast after reading his latest book, Brown Baby. It's out to buy right now and is an extraordinary exploration of race, parenting, family, grief. Part memoir, part manifesto, it's the thing of beauty and delight. It was my absolute pleasure to talk to Nikesh about all things panic years, including fatherhood, work, and sleeping in your childhood bedroom. Stick around after the interview because I'll be talking in a little more detail to an expert guest, including some very useful advice. How are you and how is your body?
I've just been stress eating loads of crisps and biscuits and then doing really intense exercise guiltily. And so I think I'm halfway between extremely stress eating and extremely exercising. So it's just sort of in the middle, I guess.
It's so interesting. That's what fine has now started to mean. I am swinging between two extremes, not I'm basically ploughing a middle furrow of fine.
Yeah.
I don't know where on that one I am this morning. I loved Brown Baby. The way you open the chapter, How to Talk About the End of the World, I think is really what I think about all the time. How we are socialized to think about having children and becoming parents. One day your daughter asks you, did you always want to have children? And you say, I'm not sure how to answer the question. I never planned to have children. I never particularly was bothered about having children. I wasn't opposed to the idea. I just couldn't think of any reasons why I'd want to introduce an element into my life that would mean I couldn't go to the pub when I wanted, go to any gig I wanted, pursue any career I wanted, regardless of salary, eat what I wanted and when, smoke fags openly, listen to Kano really loudly, wake up late, sleep erratically, and sometimes not wash my hands after a wee. And I remember reading that, and you can see I've like scrawled all over it, but I remember just thinking, how did he not think about it? How was this not a question that beguiled his like entire 20s? The kind of gnawing, should I have a child? What will that mean for me? What would it mean for my career? Am I going to be good at this? What, you know, is it fair? Is it responsible? Is that right for my relationship? Is that what, you know, all of those questions. Did you really carry it so lightly?
Just hearing that back, part of me is like, yeah, that's exactly what a man would write, right? Like, I kind of have to cop to the fact that, you know, I am a man, and therefore like that impact is so much more theoretical for me. You know, I have the male privilege of like being able to go, well, a child would really make me not do what I want to do.
I wonder if it is a privilege. You know, I sometimes think, are men denied, you know, this idea that wombs make babies, not sperm, does that mean that men are denied that feeling of engagement and responsibility and life-giving ability that women carry as a burden? Like, would that have changed your life if you'd gone through your formative years thinking, I can and I want to or I could?
I guess societally, society makes it easier for us to distance ourselves from it and make it an abstract thing. I wonder. I guess I just personally never really thought about it never considered that it was something I wanted to do because I was so focused on other things. I was so focused in my 20s on like building an artistic career, and my book came out when I was 30, and then, you know, and my mum died, and suddenly it was something that I was thinking about because I was now thinking about I don't know. I was thinking about heritage, and I was thinking about like what we leave behind, and I was thinking about how.
Did you suddenly feel compelled to create a legacy?
Well, no, I mean, it's something I sort of joke about in the sort of the opening chapter of the book. Like, it just sort of happened at a point where there was sort of nothing that made us go, well, let's not do this. It was just happened at a time where we're like, okay, well, this is what we're doing now.
That's just insane to me. It's so amazing to hear that. It's just like, it's such a lovely way to do it. That you can just be in it and then you're in the present and it's happening. In the book, you describe this beautiful moment where you look down at your daughter, and it's really poignant because she looks in that moment exactly like your mum, who you'd recently lost. But you also say the world changed utterly in that moment. And I feel like that's such a powerful, amazing thing to have.
It's funny because I think that so much of my 20s, I was incredibly selfish. And I'm not saying I'm perfect now. Like, I'm 40 now, and I'm not saying don't ever like prioritize myself.
But you're twice as good as you were at 20.
No, I'm twice as selfish as I was when I was 20. I've just doubled down. You know, in that moment, you kind of go, this isn't just about what I want anymore. And it's about how I make your life, how I help you through your life. And it was a really powerful moment for me, because I then, you know, you're kind of forced to think outside of the bubble of yourself and realize that actually this thing that you've always thought about, you know, community and how, you know, it takes a village to raise a child and all the rest of it, you know, you and your partner can do this. And it'll be hard.
They're never very specific about whether you need to live in that village. I always think that's the sort of left as a little possible loophole.
Send a child to the village.
Send a child to the village and then collect a really lovely 10-year-old.
Or just meet them when they're 24 and they're an investment banker and they're like, this is your flat at the end of our very big garden.
One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, I mean, there are so many things in the book I want to talk to you about. One of them was that the book is itself almost two fingers to the old pram in the hall idea that when you have children, it necessarily quashes your ambition and your creativity and your ability to work, because what you have done, and this is my interpretation, it may look very differently from the inside, but it looks to me like you have actually been creatively galvanized by becoming a parent, and it's made you produce brilliant work. Did you really worry that you were going to be creatively kaput after you'd had children?
It wasn't just becoming a parent that creatively galvanized me. My kid was born in 2014, like late 2014, but in early 2014, I became a youth worker. And that really galvanized me creatively, because now, you know, working with young people, seeing the impact that you can have on a young person's life just by throwing the doors open, helping them develop their voices and all the rest of it, it just made me think a lot about what I wanted my work to be and what I wanted it to stand for. And then when you kind of then have a kid and you're at like the extreme other end of like being a youth worker, you're, you know, the ultimate youth worker, the parent of a baby. And, you know, between the youth work I was doing during the day and my kid at home, I just realized what was important. And the project that I was working on, it was a real family. Like, I was working with loads of amazing creatives. Like, a bunch of them went on from, like, they were setting up Galdem at the same time as they were working with me. So I was sort of helping them to set up their magazine. And I was just seeing that the ways that helping people to develop their voice and tell their stories in the way that they wanted to tell them and needed to tell them was life-changing for people. And it made me want to write for teenagers. It made me want to write for children. It made me want to write about the world, hold a mirror up to these young people and make them feel seen in some way. And so, you know, that's where stuff like The Good Immigrant and writing YA came from. And that's ultimately where Brown Baby came from, because I wanted to then write my kids a letter. You know, I'm such a fan of James Baldwin's The Fire This Time, where he writes two letters to his nephew, and Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, where he writes a letter to his son, and David Cherry Andrews' book, I've Been Meaning to Tell You, where he writes letters to his daughters. I eat those up, you know, fathers writing books to their kids about how heavy the world can seem and the place that they can hold in it and the place they deserve to hold in it. And that's where this book came from. You know, Brown Baby was supposed to come out in 2020 and my first novel came out in 2010. And I feel like there's such a direct line between my first novel and that memoir that means that like that decade of work was about arming young kids of color in Britain to take up space in this country and feel like they deserve it, including my own kids ultimately. And now I feel sort of creatively freed of that. And also a little bit scared because now I'm like, what do I do now? But, you know, the next decade of work has to stand for something different. And in a weird way, because I'm twice as selfish as I was when I was 20, I think my 40s are going to, the decade of my 40s, my writing is going to be geared towards stuff that I really want to write about for me, you know.
Entering the world of children, your own and the ones that you were working with, or young people, suddenly means that the opportunity for change looks completely different. You know, I thought I'd become a journalist. I would, through the sheer power of writing, change people's minds. I've now realised it's much easier to just breed out the people I disagree with. You know, I can, if you spend enough time with children and young people, you can shape the future in a really beautiful way that doesn't mean having people slag you off on the internet, and it doesn't mean shouting at people at dinner parties, and it doesn't mean howling into your own indifference. Is there in how you describe the pavement and the way you approach your dinner and the way that you thank people in shops? It's tiny and it's magnificent the way that you can actually affect change with young people.
Yeah, but I think social media has kind of skewered how much change that we as individuals can make. Like, obviously, there are amazing speakers who can go on Twitter and drop one tweet and then change the perspective of hundreds and thousands of people. And that's amazing. But not all of us have the capacity to do that. And there's so often, I think people think that their way of changing the world can be quote tweeting Trump, call him a rude word, and, you know, demand his arrest. And then when nothing changes, they're like, but I did my bit. But nothing changed. And like, it's so easy to then go, oh, well, you know, nothing's ever going to change. But actually, the change has to be smaller. Like, the change you affect has to be small.
Yeah.
Renée Edo-Lodge has this lovely, amazing way of putting it where she's like, I don't, you know, she was, you know, when Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race came out, and she was constantly asked the question, how can I be a good ally to you? And she was always like, I don't want you to be an ally to me. I don't know where you hold power and influence. Do the work there and I'll do the work where I hold power and influence. And that's kind of how we have to think about all of these things. And, you know, I guess that I'm in a position where people, you know, some people, not like loads of people, but some people, if I write something, they'll listen, or it might change the way they think, or it might like validate the way they think. And that's really, really empowering. And that's great. But I can't rely on that as my way of changing the world. You know, I have to think about how I raise my kids. And I had this really interesting thing happen recently where my kid goes to a school that until recently was associated with Edward Colston. We live in Bristol. And the entire school was having a conversation about whether they should change the name or how they were going to change the name. And they wanted the kids to be on board. So they started talking to the kids about Colston and about the slave trade and Bristol, and they started talking about the Bristol bus boycotts, which was a huge piece of civil rights action that happened in the 60s. This bus company in Bristol refused to employ Black and Asian people to work on their buses, and so Black people in the city basically started boycotting the buses, and they lost loads of money, and they were sort of shamed into changing their recruitment policy. And my kid came home and she asked me about the Bristol bus boycott. And I explained it to her, and I told her that I'd met Paul Stevenson, which was a really like amazing moment for me. And, you know, I'm not above name dropping to my kids. And, you know, when I told them that I'd met the guy who played the chimney sweep in the new Mary Poppins film, they lost their shit.
And I bet.
I was like,
it's finally worth it.
I know, guys. But, while I was explaining the Bristol bus boycott to her, I realized I had to explain racism to her. And I told her about racism. I told her, there are some people who really hate people who have a different skin color to them. And, you know, we are brown, you know. And she's then asking me questions about, well, does mummy hate us because she's white? And I'm like, no, but there are some people. And she was like, but I don't understand. I don't understand this as a thing. Like, I don't get it. And to her, this is the very idea of racism was ridiculous. It was preposterous. It was silly. And I did this thing where I was like, no, well, you know, like some people might feel that way because, and then I had to stop myself because I realized I was being like intellectually dishonest with her in this moment. And I was projecting all of my cynicism about the way the world is, and they're all like the papers I read and the columns I read and the politicians who gaslight us and the advertising companies who use like rage. I was like, I can't have her see the world the way I see the world. I have to see the world on her level in order to explain it to her. And so I had to be like, yeah, you're right. It is silly. It is a silly thing.
And actually, what a glorious attitude to have. Like, this is silly, it's irrelevant, it's outdated, it's stupid, it's irrational.
Yeah, it's preposterous. I almost don't want to remove the fear of violence, but seeing the idea at its core as something that is just ridiculous, it's the right way to sort of talk about these things. And like, what's really great at the moment is we're reading this book together. That's about a princess, but it is written by Philippa Gregory, the historian. And so, like, it's very tongue-in-cheek about the patriarchy and, like, this princess is constantly asking questions about why X is a certain way. And if she's the eldest, then why is her younger brother going to be the king and all this other stuff? And it's really sort of like in a really, like, knowing way challenging the patriarchy. And she's asking loads of questions about it. And we have to be like, yeah, that's the way the world is. And that, yes, it is unfair and it is silly. I love that she's sort of challenging it, and she's challenging me as well. And the worst thing I could do is be cynical about the way the world is to her. I have to take these concepts at face value like she is and just try and dismantle them because they are inherently ridiculous.
I read it in a day, which I'm sure you're being told all the time, but it's incredibly compelling. It's so heartfelt that it felt like I didn't want to leave you halfway through. I wanted to keep going right to the end. Why did you write it?
I have this sort of funny relationship with this book because the closer you get to something coming out, the more you distance yourself from it, because you know that once it's out and people who aren't you in your team or your closed circuit of friends and colleagues and peers are going to read it, you need to give it to readers and it not belong to you anymore. And so I start doing this distancing thing where I start becoming self-deprecating about the thing that's coming out. And it's actually not the thing I want to do with this book. And so I have to stop myself and go, you know what? I bled on the page for this one. I really put everything I had into it. I think part of that was because I addressed it as a series of conversations with my daughters, and knowing that it's a piece of archive for them first and foremost just meant that it had to be real and it had to be honest. In 2018, I was briefly a columnist for The Observer magazine, writing about parenting, and I wrote a bunch of columns talking to my kids about how I was grieving for my mum and trying to explain mental health stuff to them around grief and depression and stuff. And the column was short-lived for various reasons. And I was approached by an editor afterwards to say, is there a book in your parenting columns? And at the time I was a bit like, I'm 38. Who writes a memoir at 38?
I like that you say that, because it now feels like 38 is quite late to write a memoir. Like, where were you at 22? What were you doing at 17?
But then the more we talked about it, the more I saw that actually my job as a writer is to find the extraordinary in the ordinary. And, you know, while my parenting journey hasn't been particularly out of the ordinary in any way, I can, as a writer, find like the diamonds in all the pain. I can find the beauty in like really, really like ordinary moments. And, you know, that's our job, to kind of find that joy. And so then, you know, looking out at the world and thinking about writing a memoir sort of in the aftermath of doing this book called The Good Immigrant, which came out in 2016, which was a collection of essays written by 21 British writers of colour about race and immigration that I edited. Like, promoting that book was incredibly hard for me because I was suddenly a comedy fiction writer suddenly thrust into like the world of like public intellectual columnists talking about race and immigration.
Did you do that voice the whole time? That might be where.
Well, I just realized that like for so many people, all of these conversations are so overly intellectualized. And I don't mean this to sound overly sincere or like twee or cringy, but like I'm putting my soul on the page when I write. That's what I'm doing. I'm not a writer who wants to have a stimulating intellectual debate or like flex my intellectual muscles with people. I want people to cry. I want people to laugh. I want people to like feel something. And that's why I write. Like Will Self can do whatever he wants. Like all of those other people can do whatever they want. That's just not me. And so I had to kind of put that into writing this memoir. And I realized that promoting the book had sort of taken me to a really dark place because all of these people having these sort of intellectualized debates about race and racism. And I just was like, do you guys just not see how hard it is to be in the world and to constantly have these conversations and they be couched in intellectual terms?
Oh, for the luxury for it to be a debate about linguistics or about, you know, timing or finer points of philosophy. It's like, no, this is about the actual ability to live your life without danger and fear.
And for a lot of those people, it's like eye-rolling arch conversations about the usage of the word woke, when actually the word woke doesn't belong to like Guardian columnist. The word woke comes from a civil rights movement that is still happening in America. And it is a word that Black Americans use to talk about how they view the world. And, you know, and now it's like a weird right-wing slur aimed against certain columnists. And I just thought, you know what, if I'm going to write a book, I'm going to write a book about joy. And then my friend Musarok Wongo, who's an amazing writer, he said this thing where he was like, why are the oppressed always called upon to comment upon their oppression? Why not let the oppressors hold each other to account? And it really like rattled me when he said that. If I'm to write a memoir about raising kids, I need to write towards joy. I need to write towards boundlessness because I cannot write a book that is about oppression. I need to write a book that is preparing these kids for a world that they can realistically and comfortably exist in, but a world where they don't feel hemmed in by all the stuff that I feel hemmed in by. They don't feel cynical about the world in the way I feel cynical about the world. And so that's kind of where the book came from. And so it became an act of love.
Well, you write incredibly beautifully about it. There's a little scene in the book where your daughter, well, she's confronted with her father as a public or working person for this sort of, it feels like maybe the first time.
Yeah, having to explain to her that I'm a writer is a weird thing because she sort of has a concept of what a writer is, but also she doesn't really. It's really funny. I was in a bookshop once and the person in the bookshop noticed me. They were like, oh, do you mind just signing some books? And I was like, yeah, sure. And so I was signing these books while she was looking at some kids' books, and she came over and she was like, daddy, you're not allowed to write in those books. And I was like, don't tell anyone. And playing along, the bookshop owner kind of came over and was like, why are you writing in those books? And she then realized that like all of the books that are in my house that I say I've written, they also exist out in the world, which was kind of a weird thing for her.
You write in Brown Baby, I didn't know myself until my 30s, and even then I was a person in development, which is something that we've sort of touched on, that giant switch from the mentality of your 20s to the mentality of your 30s is enormous. Do you have an anecdote that for you encapsulates that switch, which I call the panic years, which is when you seem to have to jump from one decade to the other with no warning, preparation or language?
So when I moved to Bristol in 2011, I kept my job in London. And, you know, it was probably fair to say that I probably spent most of my work days in my 20s hungover at work. I would come to London. I would stay in my childhood bedroom at my dad's house two nights a week. And I would then, you know, go back to Bristol where I was now living. And I did that for a year and a half. And it increasingly had like diminishing returns for me. Like partly there was this thing about staying two nights a week in your childhood bedroom, staring at the walls as a teenager, because like no matter how robust you think you are, there's just something about walking into your childhood home. And that's, you just revert in a weird way. But those two nights, because I didn't want to be in my childhood bedroom. I didn't want to be sitting with my grieving dad for two nights a week, both of us feeling sad about my mum passing. I just go out both those nights and get wrecked with friends. And then I'd go back to Bristol with like a 2-day hangover. And it just, it was starting to wear on me. And there was just one day where I decided not to go out or something. I'd been out all night, and then I'd got back to my dad's house at like 5 in the morning, and then I'd slept through going to work. And my dad used to work where I was working at the time, and I'd woken up to phone calls from like my boss going, "Where are you? We're all really worried about you." And I was so embarrassed about it. I rushed to a meeting, and the meeting was in a bar that had urinals that were shaped like very lipsticked lips. You were weeing into lipsticked lips. And I was sort of slumped almost over this urinal. I guess the image is supposed to be like, as you wee, it looks like this urinal is fellating you. And I was so hungover. And for some weird reason, there's a mirror above the urinal. And I just looked at myself in the mirror and went, "This isn't working for you at the moment. This isn't working for you." And
did you have children at this point?
No, I didn't. But it made me realise that I needed to find some work in Bristol so that I was in Bristol all the time rather than caught between this sort of weird hinterland of being a teenager in my teenage bedroom, getting hammered every night like a teenager, and being an adult making a new home in a new city. Mm. And so I started applying for jobs in Bristol. So it was something like that around that time. And then I ended up getting a job in Bristol. And then by the end of that year, my partner was pregnant and everything changed.
It is fast, isn't it? I mean, your 30s are quick. I can't believe how quickly that change happens when it happens. And it's completely irreversible as well, which is another thing that you don't really realise in your 20s, that once you've hit your 30s, you don't often go back to your 20s. And if you do, it's not very pretty.
No.
The only other thing I wanted to talk to you about, which is not to do with the panic years, really, is that your book, the description of what you call kidgy and I call pongal, which for people who don't know, I suppose, is when you cook rice and lentils together. So rather than having rice and dal, it was cooked together. And my sister's granny used to make it for me. That and upma are the two things that like are just the greatest comfort food in the world. But it made me think about how the way that you were parented is never the way that you parent yourself. And I wondered how you feel about that now, like that the fact that you are going to parent in the way that you were parented by your own mum and dad.
I think, but I do wonder if people make a choice to kind of go, these are all the things that I was unhappy about when I was being parented, and try and do the opposite of that. And I'm not convinced that it's necessarily the healthiest way to do it, because every now and then I catch flashes of my dad in me, you know, my dad and I are both workaholics. We both are so consumed by the things that we're doing or the things that we're working on that, you know, we can every now and then appear quite distant, but not because we're like, we're sort of physically present, but emotionally somewhere else because we're sort of thinking about the thing that we're doing. When I was growing up, that was a real source of like, my dad's not emotionally there for me. He just cares about financially providing and actually needs emotional support from, you know, a male role model, which is, you know, why I spent so much of my time looking for like a male role model to kind of help me through stuff. And I didn't realize at the time that that was just what he was bringing to the table, and that was okay. And actually I had my mum was there for all of my emotional needs, and it didn't matter that she wasn't a male role model. She loved me more than anyone, and I loved her more than anyone. And I think I do probably parent the way I was parented emotionally in some ways, but also like at the same time, I like really strive to be present as much as I can, because I know that I, you know, given half a chance, I'll just be sitting there thinking about whatever I'm thinking about, you know, or like on my phone thinking of the brilliant tweets that I tweet. I do think that sometimes we kind of make decisions to go, well, my, you know, my dad, my mum was a bit like this. I won't do this. You know, my mum was very much like, I will love you through pushing you. Whereas like, I want to love you through encouraging you and us doing stuff together. And kids need a bit of both. You know, they need a bit of independence to get on with stuff and be able to show that stuff to you so that you can go, wow, you achieved that. Now what are you going to do next? But at the same time, they need you to kind of get on the floor with them and help them out. Like, it's not an all or nothing thing.
Mm. I find it very odd when my mother's voice comes out of my mouth, apparently completely, like, I'm completely channeling something that I haven't consciously thought of for 30 years, but there it is. And I can sort of almost word for word hear her in our flat when I was a toddler telling me to how to carry scissors or whatever. It's really interesting to talk to you because I feel like there is a huge part of me that in my 20s wanted to believe that people like you were going to happen, that there were going to be people who would commit to and engage with parenting in the way that I was longing for that just didn't seem possible in our 20s. Your book is testament to the fact that you are a very conscious parent and that's all you need to be. You don't need to set out to be the best at things or to be righting the wrongs of the world. You just need to be conscious as much as you can. And I think that it definitely put the boost underneath me that I needed to kind of stop parenting on autopilot and to actually think about what I was doing, because it's the greatest creative act I've ever undertaken. That weird little blonde-haired person downstairs is the greatest creative act I've ever undertaken. Poor him. I'm so grateful to Nikesh for being so honest in that interview and for taking the time to talk to me. He is a very busy man. As we touched on in the chat, the decision of whether or not to have children could become so intertwined with our attitudes to work, career, success. So I wanted to dig down a little further into all that with the psychotherapist and life coach Dan Little to find out why we find that sort of decision-making so tricky. The first question I wanted to ask Dan was something I've thought about a lot, that the men in my life often seem to want to feel comfortable in their career before they even start to think about other aspects of their life.
I think it's a big factor. I think people work so many hours and it's so emotionally draining for people. Generally, I work a lot with people who struggle to boundary their life. They might do a 9-to-5 job, but they're still working at 10 o'clock at night. They're still working at weekends. And, you know, that's emotionally draining and physically draining as well. That tends to be what happens when people come into therapy. They're on track with their career. They're putting all their energy into it. And then something else comes up. You know, they have another big life event come up and they don't have the resources. I don't feel like they have the resources to manage it. So I think it's really about reflecting upon your boundaries and taking care of yourself through that time, giving yourself enough space to have the energy to reflect and think about these things.
If someone comes to you and they're feeling like that, that their sort of bandwidth is entirely taken up, what advice do you give them? Are there sort of exercises that you give them to do? Or is it more of a case of getting them to change the framing of that psychologically?
Yeah, I don't think there's one thing that works particularly. But firstly, just kind of acknowledge that, how is that person feeling about it? To really help them to understand and to be able to name that, how are you feeling about this, your experience at the moment? And it might be how they're experiencing it in the moment, but also how they feel about it. Or the big decision that's coming up, or that they have to make.
If we think about how are people feeling, I think they're really defined by self-doubt. And I think that self-doubt in your career can make it really hard to move forward professionally, personally, because you're kind of carrying around a feeling that you are either not worthy or not achieving enough or not able, or like you say, you don't have the resources. I know you can't really solve it, but how do you tackle self-doubt?
I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there, that we have that kind of core belief about ourselves. I think it's individual for everyone. We tend to have that belief, you know, it might be that I'm not good enough in the world, or I'm not worthy, or I'm not lovable. And that then spawns a whole pattern of thoughts, feelings, and then behaviours. And I think people have more recently termed it as imposter syndrome, which I find is probably a less helpful way of thinking about it. as well as that person feeling like they're not in the right place. Imposter syndrome also kind of implies that you're then deceiving other people as well.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So you're like, you're tricking everyone.
So by putting on that facade, as people see it, we're also kind of not telling the truth to people. And that, again, I think we can't talk about self-doubt without talking about shame. And I think that's the biggest feeling that people try and avoid. So it's almost like the fear of being shamed. What if I'm found out? What if that secret that I don't want someone to know is exposed? What will people think of me then? How will I feel then? How will it impact me? And then we start to kind of catastrophize about our future and what might happen.
Something I've noticed since having a kid, in order to have a good relationship with a child, you have to be basically completely emotionally open with them. And so that feeling of shame, or like getting away with it, or trying on a facade, or having like a professional face, is really tricky. So if you're someone who sort of feels like you're just about squeaking by with this sort of professional or almost civilized exterior, having a kid is going to really rupture that. You're going to be brought down to kind of something a bit more basic and maybe a bit more uncomfortable. Do you think that puts people off sometimes? That can put you off the idea of becoming a parent?
I think having a child is a good way of heightening your emotional experience. It's a very intense thing to do.
Hell yeah.
You know, that can be quite a scary place for people who may not quite understand their own emotional experience. Yeah, and so, you know, it's not something we're particularly taught in schools. I think there's a lot of social messages going around, you know, talk about the messages that men get, you know, it's not okay to cry. It's acceptable to be angry, but not much else.
Yeah, so there was the amazing study about how at 8 years old, boys are already, there's a difference in their emotional vocabulary, that they basically can talk about anger and maybe fear or jealousy, but like all the other language around how you're feeling, it gets restricted even from so young.
And there's a lot of kind of messages that we get about being a parent, you know, not just from our family life, but from also society. You know, this is how you should be as a parent. You know, there's very little space for people to explore that, I think, for themselves. The pressures of being a parent is immense. People are having to work full time. They're having to parent full time. They're having to be a partner full time. And having to keep a house full time. You know, these things are just immense pressures. And when we feel stressed, we don't feel like we have the resources to tackle that. And I think when we get into that place, that's when our kind of narrative kicks in. You know, if you've got that sense of I'm not good enough in the world, well, and that's the thing about self-doubt. Someone's saying to themselves, or there's a part of them that's saying to them, don't do that thing. It's going to be painful. It's going to feel really intense and you're not going to like it. And the survival part of our brain goes, it's kind of dangerous. It could kill you. That's because our brains physically, the way it haven't evolved as much as we have socially. I think having that sense of, are you in survival mode? Are you in emotional mode? Or are you in a thinking mode? I think as people in society, we're more comfortable with some emotions and not on others. We hold our emotions physically. It's that felt sense that we want to avoid. That's really uncomfortable for me. I don't like it. I'm going to avoid it. Because we're attuned to survive. We don't want to suffer or experience pain. I'm not going to go for that job interview because what if I'm rejected? And the feeling that follows with that.
When self-sabotage feels like control, I always think that's a really interesting point in your sort of emotional makeup, where you can exit or end a relationship, or you can not go to a job interview, or you can not go and view a house, because then it feels like control, even though you're basically shutting down your options. But at least you feel like you're in control. Mm. Obviously, it's different for everybody and it depends on how you're educated and your background and everything. But for me and for a lot of my peers, their 30s really felt like a massive crunch time, that like, if you didn't make it, quote unquote, make it now, you'd lost it. That was your one chance. And so the idea of throwing in something like a family, like having a baby or entering a new relationship, getting married, changing country, the idea of doing something significant like that felt like it was compromising your ability to have a career. How can we sort of navigate that, what is a crunch time, without it feeling quite so suffocating or stressful?
I would view that as like how we manage any kind of stress in our life, focusing on the things that keep you well during those stressful times. You know, who can you connect to? Well, firstly, understanding, you know, what stress is and how you respond to it. You know, some people withdraw from relationships. Some people engage in self-sabotaging behaviours. I think understanding ways to come out of stress. So it's like a survival response stress. I don't have the faculties to deal with this and I've got to keep myself alive because this is too much. I think noticing what your body is doing is really important. Our nervous system holds stress. So knowing how to come out of that at any given point is really important. And that will give us the energy. It's like the theory of motivation. We need to be able to regulate our emotional experience. So without going too much into detail, we've got like a sympathetic and parasympathetic part of our nervous system. So one's essentially the accelerator that goes, go, 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 adrenaline, survive. And the other one's the brake that kind of goes rest and digest. Let's slow things down. So I think when people are stressed, and certainly, you know, in work, there's a lot of things going on. There's another problem I've got to deal with. The accelerator seems to be on quite a lot. So if someone's working 50 hours a week, then it's more on than it is off. So I think we need to learn ways to take our foot off the accelerator and apply the brake. And you're just basically telling your body that this isn't life and death. But just to tell your body that, hey, we're not there. We're fine. It's about getting the basics right, I think. When people come to therapy, the first things I focus on is the basics. Hydration, nutrition, exercise, sleep. Sleep's massive. It's really, really important to us as human beings. And I think any kind of mental health issue can be improved generally by just having good sleep.
What an amazing thing that you could turn up to a therapist and say like, oh my God, I've got like all these meetings and my kids do stress, all right. And they just say like, let's talk about having a sandwich and a nap. But like, actually, there is a lot to be said for that. And I think if you've had young children, you see it in such sharp relief that though a hungry or tired child is completely unable to cope with the world. And there is definitely a little version of me inside that cannot cope with being hungry or tired.
Yeah. And it's not a good mix when you as a parent are hungry and tired and your child's hungry and tired and no one's got the resources to manage it. And
then you just eat your child. That's fine. Then you that's the way around that one. I've sorted that.
Problem solved.
Hello. Thank you for listening and thank you for staying with us right to the end. Thanks so much to Nikesh and Dan for their time and conversation. And thank you to my producer, Rich, for all his hard work. Next week's guest is the utterly tremendous writer, journalist and podcaster Pandora Sykes. What a treat. Pandora and I will be talking about female fragmentation, the decision to become a mother and the changing nature of identity. So come back next Friday for all of that. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, and actually, even if you haven't, please subscribe and leave me a glowing 5-star review so more people can find it. It makes a huge difference. It feels great. And like scratching an insect bite, it's completely free. Thank you and goodbye.
This is a brand new audio production.